sells hell, but a
down. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Consumers Matter. I am your host, Michael Forbes, and I'm here with my co-hostess and lovely, incredible wife, Nancy Forbes.
Wait, we're not going to be required to sing, are we? Because you clearly are.
I would never require
co-host.
You to sing, believe me. But okay. And we are broadcasting from downtown Westchester, beautiful downtown Westchester. We have the most powerful radio show in Westchester this morning. It can be heard
ever.
Everywhere in the studio. So today we have a special guest, and we'll have our features. Our special guest is Larry Rubin. He is an attorney whose office is in Delaware County, but he practices everywhere in the area. And Larry does what I do to a large extent, which is handling consumer law, and we'll talk about that and what that means. But he is, I can't say that Larry is an icon, and in my mind he's an icon, but he has the most iconic case that has helped me win probably, you know, 99% of my mortgage foreclosure defense cases and credit card defense cases, based on a case that he handled esteemed Judge Burr, who's now retired, and we'll talk about him. And also we have our features, which is the bottom feeder of the week, and that's somebody we pick out or a company each time we're on the air that has really done something to hurt consumers. And, of course, we have it on our podcast, the Mick Mulvaney moment of the week.
My favorite.
Or the Mick Mulvaney anything, which you know is bad news. We also have our call-in features with Rich DeFalco, who handles the financial report, and Peter Pasquarelli, who is the longtime writer for the Inquirer. I think he always gets mad at me because I get one of them mixed up with the other, the Daily News. But he was the ESPN Major League Baseball announcer till he retired. So we kind of mixed some of that stuff in, and I went and asked Pete about the Phillies tickets and the prices.
Yikes.
I looked up the 1964 World Series prices. I had two tickets on the cork board of my wall in my bedroom when the Phillies lost the last 10 out of the last games, 10 out of the 11 last games of the season, and were blown out of the pennant race.
Wait a minute. Is this a story of you get what you pay for?
Well, and that, with the Phillies, pretty much that has been their history since it took 98 years to win a World Series. But through the tears of my eyes, I had to take down those Phillies tickets. I was so distraught. But anyway, so we'll start the show. And just to give you an idea, what we do as what we call consumer lawyers, there's different types of law that people practice. There's personal injury, which my office also does. That's accident cases, medical malpractice, products liability and such, family law, divorce, custody, so forth and so on, real estate law, business law. Consumer law has to do with what happens to you as individuals where you are protected by certain rights given to you under either federal or state laws. So if you're sued for defaulting on a credit card case or allegedly defaulting on it, the credit card company has to prove the terms of the card and the amount due and when the default occurred. If on a mortgage you are sued for failure to make payments, the mortgage company has to sue you in order to take the house to sheriff's sale. And they've got to prove certain things, which are the validity of the mortgage, the promissory note, the amount due, the account history, and, you know, they're the correct party in the case, because a lot of the credit cards and mortgages are sold to third-party debt buyers, which brings us to Larry's case that he won, which was Commonwealth Financial Systems versus Larry Smith. And if I remember Larry Rubin, Larry Smith was a woman.
That's right.
Which confused me as I was reading the transcript. And I remember reading it. I'm thinking, who are they talking about? Just the assumption that Larry Smith was a man and finding that she was a woman.
If you don't mind, I just want to interrupt to give the call-in number if somebody has a question for you or Larry. And it's 610-701-9243.
Okay. Larry, just a little background on your practice. Where is your office located?
Oh, I'm at 337 West State Street in Media.
In Media. Yeah, we used to be, at 406 West State Street.
That's right.
Yeah, Media was a great town to practice in. And it's, I look out at Westchester, I see the same thing. And although Westchester seems to be a little more, current than Media is these days, but they're getting there.
Hard to say.
It's hard to say. And what do you do in your practice? What kind of law do you handle?
Well, I mostly do consumer law and I do consumer bankruptcy, but like you, I have a general practice. I'll take other cases if they are interesting or if they suit me. So, but generally, I'm probably maybe 50% consumer bankruptcy and maybe 40% consumer law.
Well, when you say consumer bankruptcy, that's Chapter 13 and Chapter 7?
That's right. Chapter 13 and Chapter 7 are the main chapters for consumers.
And just, Nancy and I know the differences, but if you can explain that, the difference between a 13 and a 7.
Well, Mike, if somebody was in foreclosure like you're handling and they didn't want to go through a mortgage defense, they could always file what's called a Chapter 13. A Chapter 13 would allow them to take the arrears that they owe on their house or on their car or any other secured property. Generally, it is a house. And they could pay it out over a 60-month period max. So they would actually get a chance to reinstate a defaulted mortgage. So the court has a lot of authority and a lot of power. It's a very potent chapter to file. You can actually reverse a default, even if you're like a day before a sheriff's sale. So people have come in. Well, actually, I hate it when they come in a day before the sheriff's sale.
Well, we all do. I've had that many times.
Yeah, but I mean, if they do, they do. You have to take the clients, as you find them. So,
and when they file the bankruptcy, doesn't that take away the jurisdiction or the power of the court where the judgment is or where the sheriff's sale is taking place?
Well, it doesn't take away the jurisdiction. It stays the jurisdiction. So the court is stayed. The court still has authority to adjudicate if let's say the stay is lifted.
Yeah, but during the stay period, there's no collection activities, sheriff's sale is, that can take place against the client.
Well, stay is the same thing as an injunction. The bankruptcy court has the right to issue the stay or injunction, and it enjoins all courts. It enjoins all courts everywhere.
And enjoin means that they can't. It stops them.
Yeah, stay, stop, injunction.
Stay, stop, injunction.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. What it is, the people just want to know, is my house going to be sold? I have a case right now. I've gotten maybe 10 emails. Is my house going to be sold? And I keep saying no. When you file the bankruptcy, there will be stay. And they say, but I need this house. I said, well, I just said there'd be a stay. And they say, but it's sheriff's sale, it's Friday. And I said, well, as long as the court enters a stay before Friday, you're okay.
Well, people get nervous.
Oh, this is particularly nervous.
I mean, we get that all the time. And you can explain it 10 times. And I understand it. For us, it's like the back of our hand. I mean, we just do this all the time. So, there's a stay. It'll stop everything.
Right.
And then you get the phone call again.
Lawyers tend to have too much knowledge, and they assume that everybody else has the same knowledge.
That's a very good point.
Yeah. But that's a good thing, because then they wouldn't be a lawyer in a living if everybody had that knowledge.
Yeah, that's something I didn't think of before, but you're right about that.
Keeping us stupid.
Yeah, but you
it's
don't.
It's a big conspiracy.
Oh, wait, it's not on purpose.
It's what we don't want you to know.
Yeah, uncovered.
Yeah, but the problem is people then Google information. They go, well, on the Internet, I found this, that, and the other. I said, well, the Internet was wrong.
Right. The Internet doesn't make you smart. It
no.
just gives you raw information.
Yeah.
So
it gives you some basic stuff, but it's not the stuff.
So in a chapter, you have to take the call. In a Chapter 13, the court enters a stay, and it allows the parties in the case to file what's called the Chapter 13 plan. And a plan is what it sounds like. It's a plan of repayment. And during the plan, and during the time the plan is active, the stay still continues, and people can start to make payments on the plan. And at the end of the plan, provided that they've made all the payments, the mortgage is reinstated and the default is taken away. So the reinstatement means you're all good. The mortgage is back to where it was before you defaulted.
Provided that they stay in the plan for whatever period of time it is, up to the 5-year.
And that's a big
plan.
Provided, because a lot of people have a hard time keeping up with plan payments, keeping up with payments to the mortgage company, because you have to continue to make payments.
Yeah, you have to make your regular payments.
Right, right.
Plus, you have to pay what you owe and what we call arrearages, what you're behind on. And I think the trustee, do they still add 10% onto that?
That varies. It is now about 7.
Oh.
Between 7 and
discount.
8. It goes up and down.
Got discounted since... They passed that law when I stopped doing bankruptcy.
The trustee. Yeah.
Okay, let's take a break here and listen and pick up on Rich DeFalco with our economic and financial news.
Wow, is Rich on the phone?
I hope so.
Rich is here. Good morning, everybody.
Hey, Rich. Long time. How are you?
Doing well. How are you guys doing?
Good. Thanks for calling in. It's our first time that you called in with a feature on information that most of us don't understand, but you talk the talk and walk the walk, so that's why we have you, and we're paying you the big bucks.
That's right. I appreciate it.
Which your check will come in about 30 years, by the way. Don't hold your breath.
Perfect. Is my check coming?
Yeah, your check's in the mail. It got mail from another planet.
Exactly.
Well, what's going on, Rich? What's going on in the world of high finance and economics?
Well, once again, it was an interesting week. I mean, we had 5 straight sell-off days, culminating with some economic data that came out yesterday, which many probably have heard, that Wall Street expected unemployment jobs to be about 180,000 jobs to be added, and only the number came in at 20,000.
Which is astounding.
Astounding. The talking heads, if you will, were just, you know, totally baffled on what occurred. And, you know, that led to, overall, there's a lot of other signs in this economy right now that they're showing it's slowing down a bit. A couple of the positive things, though, one of the positive things is that wages were up for the month of February, 0.5%, which gives us, you know, wages up almost 4% for the past 12 months, which is something very positive. 63% of the population is working in the United States, so that's another positive.
Well, that's good.
And even with only adding 20,000 jobs, the unemployment rate dropped to 3.8% from 4% that was in January.
Interesting. But we've had 10 years, I think I read, of sustained growth now since Bush got out of there. And
we are getting close to our 10-year anniversary of this bull market.
How long? What's the longest bull market? Do you have any idea? I mean, this just seems really long.
We're in it.
That's what I thought.
It's uncharted territories right now.
Well, I read something yesterday where the New York real estate market is starting to soften, and that's a bad indicator for going forward. I don't know if you saw that or what your thoughts are on that.
Actually, that is correct. Not only in New York, but, you know, throughout the U.S. right now, where the losses this week were experienced in the Dow Jones Industrial Averages was in construction and housing. And, you know, the only two industries that were up was manufacturing. But it wasn't up enough to create, you know, a positive swing in the Dow. So, yeah, it's starting to, the economy overall in the U.S. is starting to slow.
Is that an indicator? Is that what we use as an indicator as far as construction and real estate?
Yeah, that's the major one. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the major one here. I mean, we are a consumer-driven economy, and you know, if people, you know, are working and wages are up, you know, but housing is down, people not buying houses. You know, it is a concern, no doubt.
You know, you never know it from driving around. It seems like there's new construction everywhere. You know, where we live, there was a quarry, and we drove by a few weeks ago. Now there's a hotel. I mean, it's sprung out of nowhere, and I seem to see new developments and advertisements all over the place. I remember back before the crash that kind of stuff was happening, and then you had a lot of vacant buildings after that. Do you think it's analogous, or is this just I'm reading into it too much?
It might be a little reading into it, but it also depends where in the country. I mean, you're speaking about a developed area here where the population is growing. You know, the major cities, you know, a lot of people are still here, you know, but the country is pretty big. and a lot of other areas that are not growing, not building. You know, yes. A lot of depression throughout the Midwest, you know, in this country. So it's hard to say. You just happen to live in an area that there's a lot of bricks and mortar going up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
So.
Yeah.
But,
So Larry, Rich, I'm looking at Larry, I'm talking to you.
Guess.
Rich, do we buy short, sell long? How's that work?
Well, you know what? We're at a time now that there's a lot of uncertainty.
So buy both.
You know, truly, the U.S. dollar currently is very strong against, foreign currencies. But that's because the rest of the world is in such a depression.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, right now, China is in its worst depression in many years. In fact, they're very concerned about this trade agreement, that's going to be proposed with the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, President Xi is looking at it as, the current administration walked out of the Vietnam summit, because he didn't get his way. If President Xi ends up in Mar-a-Lago playing golf, administration may just pick up his ball and leave. And there'll be a lot of egg on the guy's face if that happens. So, overall, it's uncertainty. To answer your question, though, this industry has always had pretty much two major categories. People that are bullish, people that are bearish. I'm playing the card that I'm a squirrel now. I'm just going to collect my nuts, hold on to them, and see what this whole thing goes.
No puns intended, of course.
No puns intended, exactly.
I thought squirrels collected acorns, by the way. So,
the joke wouldn't have worked. It was
silly you.
Well, Rich, we're going to wrap up. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you, Rich.
Really appreciate it. You always know stuff that I have no idea what you're talking about. But no, I know what you're talking about, but it's always interesting.
You
and you always give me a lot of great insights.
No problem. Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
Thanks you
Rich.
Too.
Bye.
Take care. That was Rich DeFalco, and he really knows his stuff. And we've had a lot of discussions, economic discussions, that, he always amazes me with his knowledge. Anyway, speaking of that, let's get back to Larry Rubin. And we were talking about bankruptcy, but I want to switch the topic a little bit to what you do in terms of credit card defense cases. So if I run a real very quick scenario, this is typical. There's two types of companies that sue people in credit card cases. If there's a third one, let me know. I can't think of it right now.
Yeah, but basically that's correct.
Yeah, it's the original creditor. Mm-hmm. So let's say it's Bank of America, Capital One, Citibank, companies like that. And then you have the next column, which are the debt buyers. And you have companies like Midland Funding, LVNV Funding, and a whole bunch of other ones that seem to pop up that buy the credit cards that are allegedly in default for anywhere between 2 to 5 cents on the dollar. And then they sue you as though they are the original credit card company. And you had the seminal case that we all rely on when we go into court. And I can't tell you how many times, just as a little bit of an anecdote, I've walked into court. I carry this case in my car. I have several copies of it. And I've handed it to numerous judges. They all know it now, but this has been going on for years. And hand it up, and they go, wow, you're right. They can't prove their case. So the first time I encountered it, I was actually in front of Judge Burr and Judge Charles Burr is in Delaware County. He's now retired, and he was a really smart man, still is, and quite a colorful person up on the bench.
Harvard graduate.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that speaks, underscores what I just
I think
said.
It's Harvard Law.
That's amazing.
So you don't mess around with it.
You don't mess around. I know a lot of lawyers who litigated against him. I think he was an insurance defense lawyer. Every one of them said, that guy's really smart. He's also a lot of fun to be around, and he's enjoyable to be in the courtroom with.
He can't seem to sit in his seat.
No, he likes. That's
he
a good
walks
point.
Around the courtroom.
He stands up and walks around.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I
he paces.
He can do
he's
that.
A moving target.
Yeah. Sometimes we were like stationary targets in the courtroom. So the first case I had where the Smith issue came up, which has to do with hearsay and a subsequent creditor or a debt buyer has to prove the account history made by somebody else. So think about it. You know, you're taking over somebody else's work, and you're going, oh, everything they did was great and perfect. Well, how do you know that? You have a computer printout. You don't know. In accounting, we used to call it garbage in, garbage out.
Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, right?
Right, exactly. That's a good analogy. So I go into court, and I was about an $800,000 judgment. It was a commercial loan, and my client's business was going downhill. So eventually, he was going to be out of business. But we were fighting it, and these two guys from one of the big law firms in Philadelphia come in. And Judge Burry asked us to go back in the back room. It's like the courtroom chambers. And he's sitting at his desk. The three of us are next to each other. And he goes, all right, Michael, what's your defense? I'm like, why are you putting this on me? They have to prove their case. So I said, Judge, Commonwealth Financial Systems versus Larry Smith. And he breaks out into this big smile. And we both at the same time, he reached into his drawer. I reached into my briefcase. We both pulled out his opinion. And he looks at the other guys, what do you think of that?
That's great.
And they said, what is it? And they realized they didn't have a witness from the prior creditor there, and they were going to lose a trial.
They said, what is the case?
Yeah, what is the case? They had no.
Wow.
I ran into that multiple times at trial.
Still?
Years ago. And so we ended up working out a settlement because I didn't want my guy personally liable. Because what they would have done is withdraw the lawsuit and then refile it and, go after him personally. But I've been in court with him, and that led to my mortgage foreclosure case, U.S. Bank National versus Plotinus, which we relied on Smith, and we won a trial, and we won on appeal with the Superior Court. So we're going to discuss that, and you handle the trial on the Smith case,
right,
with Judge Burr. So
right.
What happened there?
Well, it actually had a long and storied precursor to that case. It actually started out as an arbitration. No, actually, it started out as a default against Smith because Smith had been to magistrate district court with that case originally before she handled me. I mean, before she hired me. And she came into my office with several volumes of notes and in a binder and said, look at this. And so I said, okay, I'll take a look at it. And as soon as she left the office, I just put it on the shelf. I figured I'm not going to bother with all this stuff. I said, I don't get paid enough.
I know that move.
I don't get paid enough for this. So I appealed her case, and it promptly went on somebody's desk in OJS, which is the prothonotary, which is the clerk of the court. And that person went on vacation and did not docket the appeal, and that was dismissed. And it took me 9 months to get it reinstated. All the time, the plaintiff's law firm was accusing me of doctoring the record, of being dishonest to the court. And I said, look, I filed the case. I don't know. I have a timestamped copy. And so eventually when I got that, that was reversed by Judge Zatusky, actually, of all people.
Of all, Judge Zatusky.
Yeah, the most cantankerous judge.
And he was quite the character, too.
Yeah. So we eventually went to an arbitration, which is a three-attorney panel, which handles cases before they go to judges. And I did not bring Larry Smith to the courtroom because I rarely bring defendants to the courtroom. God forbid they should say they owe the debt, right?
I mean, well, here's the thing. Just for clarification, in criminal cases, you have to bring the defendant to the courtroom unless otherwise excused by the court for reason.
But because you have to answer for the crime.
They have to be there. In civil cases, you do not have to bring your client to the courtroom. You make the plaintiff prove the case. I've been on both sides. And unless you are sent what's called a notice to attend, which is a subpoena sent directly to the attorney for the mm-hmm. defendant, you don't have to bring your client. And
right.
So you didn't bring your client. You made them try to prove their case.
Right. There's a reason that you don't bring your client, because your client is actually your own worst enemy. Because your client will go and testify that they that they owe them money. I mean,
well, here's what happens, and I had this happen the other day. I called somebody, called a potential client, and I said, "What do you think you owe?" And he goes, "Well, they said." So I don't. Who cares what they said? They're not right most of the time, and I didn't mean that in a disrespectful way, but you know, what do you think you owe? And he didn't know. And so what happens is when your client's there, they may even think it's not their card or they don't know what it is. Like, for instance, well, you think it's your card? What was your 16-digit credit card number? I don't know. What were the last four digits? I don't know. Well, how do you know it's your card? And we've had those cases where they've mixed up the cards. Years ago, Chase had – it was Chase? Yeah. They had that problem with Linda Almonte, that whole fiasco, where they mixed everybody's cards up. So anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just wanted to give a little background on that.
Well, and by way of what do you think you owe, it's virtually impossible to tell what you owe because the interest rate changes constantly.
Right.
It may go up or down because of a default. They don't even tell you half the time, or maybe you threw away the notice, like everybody does. And even if you had the notice in front of you, you have a calculator in your head and you're calculating all the interest. So by definition, almost nobody knows what they owe.
And I won a case down in Philadelphia that way where my client was there. And the judge said, well, what? He said to the plaintiff, and they had a witness there, what was the interest rate on such and such date? I don't know. What was it on that date? How did you calculate the changes? And we won the case.
Well, the credit card companies generally make it so complicated. I mean, if you look at their agreements, they're usually single-spaced, double-sided, 10 pages long, and it talks about all the various terms and how the interest rates can change, what notice they have to give you, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody reads it. It just immediately goes in the trash, and they know that.
Right.
And so they send it to you. They slip it in with your bill, and you're looking through the bill, and you go, what is this? I don't get it. Throw it away. You know, how much do I owe? So at that point, people may know what they owe. 10 days later, not so much, you know, because it's already changed.
Right.
You know, so it's really a moving target.
So you went to arbitration.
Arbitration and won. Because they, like at trial, they were unable to produce authentic documents. And I objected. They did not have a contract. They could not authenticate a contract.
When you say they could not authenticate a contract,
well, there's a rule in most Pennsylvania courts called 1305 where you could admit contracts if you give notice to the other side. And although this happened like 10 years ago, so I'm a little lazy on exactly what happened at the arbitration.
You don't remember 10 years ago?
No, I don't even remember walking into this studio.
I don't remember yesterday. Yeah. I do remember walking in, but that was about it.
But anyway, to make a long story short, I guess it's too late for that, but we won at the arbitration, and they immediately appealed, and that's how we got before Judge Burr. And then it started getting serious. Then they said, you know, we're going to bring a witness. The guy's name was Danny Venditti, and he's going to kick your butts, and he's going to testify as to all the things that we couldn't do at the arbitration. And you'll be sorry, Ruben, you know, and so.
Well, I just as an aside,
I'll be sorry, Ruben.
One of the first times that I had to use the Smith case was in a small claims court. Yeah. And I handed up to the judge and we walked out and the lawyer on the other side said, do you know that I'm the one that wrote the opinion for the debt buyer? He may have even been the trial lawyer. I don't remember who it was. I said, wow, that was a big mistake, wasn't it?
It wasn't Matzkin.
No, somebody from his firm.
Matzkin was the attorney for the
lawyer. Right, so it was somebody else from his firm. He wrote the brief.
It was a good brief.
It was a brief, yeah.
It cited about 100 cases. I was going crazy. I had to get two extensions. There were like literally about 100 cases cited.
Wow.
In there.
Which obviously.
They were just trying to snow you with paper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And most of them were from other jurisdictions.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. That's how they did it. They well, let's get back to what happened at trial. Do we need to take a.
Yes, we really do, if you don't mind. We'll be right back.
If you have an oil burner furnace, did you know that you should have it tuned up every year? And if you do, have you made arrangements to have it done this season? Now, if you're a procrastinator, here's a newsflash. It's not too late. You can have your oil burner serviced any time of the year, including wintertime. Fortunately, I know just who you should call. Rick Scheibe and my friends at Chester County Fuel Oil. You can call right now. Don't wait. Number 610-344-7234. That's 610-344-7234. Here's the best way to do it. Sign up with Chester County Fuel Oil for one of their annual oil burner maintenance service contract options, which will help ensure your system remains in tip-top condition all year long. Remember, Chester County Fuel Oil has been voted best fuel oil delivery company 6 years in a row for the Daily Local News People's Choice Award. So do what I've been doing for many years and have your oil burner serviced by the pros at Chester County Fuel Oil.
Governor Wolf has delivered his budget address, outlining his wish list for the upcoming budget year. Education spending is once again in the spotlight, as well as an increased minimum wage. A revised plan to impose a fee on municipalities who rely on the state police is also getting a lot of attention. Turn to PA Post for unbiased analysis of the governor's plan and follow along with us as negotiations move forward. Trusted reporting about all things Pennsylvania, including the state budget, is online at papost.org.
At WSFS Bank, we stand for service. For some people,
good morning, Mrs. Johnson.
Great service means friendly faces at more locations. For others, it's mobile banking, so your money moves with you. For nearly 200 years, we've made serving customers our number one priority. So whatever you or your business stand for, we'll stand right by your side. We're WSFS Bank, and our friends call us WSFS, and we stand for service. Visit WSFSBank.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 417673.
This is Bill Mason from the WCHE Morning Magazine Show, and I'm here to tell you that all insurance agents are not created equal. For me, it's all about having the combination of great rates from an established company like State Farm, combined with the personal service you can only get from a local agent who will actually be there when you really need them. That's why I'm proud to tell everybody I know that Willie Anderson is my insurance agent. He's always been my agent since 1992, and I know that when I've needed him, and there's been a couple times, he's always been there. Willie has the entire line of State Farm insurance products, homeowners, life, automobile, and renter's insurance. And over the years, Willie's become more than just an insurance agent. He's become a friend. And Willie gets back to the community as a board member of the Brandywine YMCA and the Danningtown Chamber of Commerce, and very quietly, without any fanfare, supports many local charities. Now, to find out if Willie can save you money the way he saves me money, give him a call at his office in Danningtown at 610-873-9957. That's 610-873-9957. Or visit him online at willieanderson.net. Willie's been looking out for me for the last 20 years. Let him look out for you, too. That's State Farm agent Willie Anderson.
Curious about the world around you? From politics and gardening to unlocking the secrets of longevity, Experience Mind Matters, a free series created especially for baby boomers and beyond. Mind Matters is a series for older adults to watch, learn about new things, and then engage with their peers. Contact your local senior center for more information. To locate your nearest center, visit aging.pa.gov. Again, that's aging.pa.gov.
The intense heat and rain this summer has done tremendous damage to many roofs, and you might be a victim of the weather and not even know it. Rain and heat can work into your roof, leaving irreparable damage that'll surface when you least expect it. With leaking, flooding, and just nightmarish conditions, don't wait till it's too late. Get your roof inspected now, today, before the damage runs into thousands of dollars. GP Martini has trucks on the road all throughout the area and can respond to your call quickly. If you need a new roof and it fails in any way within its normal lifetime, GP Martini will repair or replace the roof at no charge to you. No other roofer offers that guarantee. Plus, Martini offers a very easy payment plan with no fees or interest for 12 months. And as a reminder, you might want to ask about a beautiful new metal roof. Call this number now before it's too late. 610-873-1696. 610-873-1696. Or go to the website martiniroofing.com.
Rich is just a really, really, really good guy. The term good egg isn't enough to describe him. He's also certified organic and free range. Rich puts the cap back on everything. The toothpaste, the olive oil, the shampoo, everything. He lets his 10-year-old nephew beat him at virtual tennis, even though he can straight up slay his 10-year-old nephew in virtual tennis. When the toilet paper is running low, Rich replaces the roll on the actual holder, not just on the back of the toilet. Rich is texting and driving. Rich? No. What are you doing, Rich? I was just telling everyone how great you are. Texting and driving makes good people look bad. Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
What is everyone talking about in Chester County? Find out on the News at Noon here on 1520 WCHE.
Won't be turned around, and I'll keep.
Welcome back to Consumers Matter with Michael Forbes and Nancy Forbes, and our guest today, Larry Rubin, attorney in Media, Pennsylvania. And we're discussing credit card defense cases and Larry's practice, which is focused on consumer law. Larry, getting back to the Commonwealth Financial Systems versus Larry Smith case before Judge Burr, from what I remember in the transcript, right before trial, we talked about how you don't bring your clients to court. And I mentioned how if they get subpoenaed or you get this notice to attend, you are required to bring them to court. I think the day before trial, you received a notice to attend by the credit card company, or the debt buyer, Commonwealth Financial System. What happened there? Because you didn't bring your client to court. How did that work out?
Well, when I came in the morning, I noticed that there was a fax from Commonwealth's attorney, Mr. Matzkin, and it was a notice to appear. I'm sorry, it was a notice to appear for my client, which is the same as a subpoena. You don't have to actually have a subpoena.
Yeah, I call it a notice to attend. Some of them call it a notice to appear.
Same thing. And I had a decision to make whether to actually call up Larry Smith, who... I said she was elderly, but now I'm not so sure.
Well,
she was not elderly.
Well, you're now elderly.
Yeah.
You're not going to remember that.
I didn't know whether to actually drag her into court or whether it was my obligation to bring her to court. And so I
But let me just say this: it's also a day before, and in Judge Burr's opinion, you know, he said this may have been part of your strategy not to bring her. You'd have to call her. You'd have to get her in. You have to prep her. You have to change your schedule around.
It actually was part of my strategy. That was the strategy in the case. And so I decided, no, I'm not going to bring her to court. And so when we got to trial, Mr. Matzkin, the attorney for Commonwealth, was complaining that she wasn't there. And I said, you knew that she wasn't coming. That's why you sent the notice. She wasn't even at the arbitration. And so Matzkin said, no, I didn't know. And I told the judge, I said, I think he's being disingenuous. Obviously, the person, the client, was not at the arbitration. And, you know, he should have known. And, in fact, he did know, because otherwise he wouldn't have sent the notice out. So...
That's a good point.
I brought to the judge's attention the rule, and I believe the rule said that you can send the notice to attend or appear, you know, as long as you give reasonable notice. A lot of times the courts, when they write the word reasonable, they just leave it up to the judge to decide what's reasonable. And I was accused of being disingenuous with the court or trying to... manipulates. And so Judge Burr said, no, Mr. Matzkin, that is his strategy. That is a correct thing he can do. If he wants to try a case like that, he certainly can. And, you know, I'm not going to compel her to come into court because she doesn't have to come. I mean, you're the plaintiff. You have a burden of proof.
Well, the other part of it is, and look, we all get in these things because these deadlines creep up on you. And we're all doing a lot of other cases, but they had, I don't know what the time period was, I don't remember, between the arbitration and the trial, but it's usually at least 3 months.
Oh my
longer.
God, yes, it was more than 6 months. I think it was close to 9 months.
So they had 6 months, or nine months to send you the notice to attend or notice to appear.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they waited until the day before. So the only people responsible for that are, you know, the lawyers for the debt buyer.
With notice that the person didn't appear, too.
Right.
At the prior arbitration, because that attorney was at the arbitration.
Right.
So he knew that there was a good likelihood. My strategy was not secret strategy.
No, it's common. It's well known.
Right. And so Judge Burr said she didn't have to appear. You have the burden of proof. You have to go forward. Call your first witness, Mr. Metzgen.
That's great.
And that's how the trial went.
Okay, well, we're going to talk more about it. I think we have a phone call here. Okay, well, so we're going to break to talk to Peter Pascarelli, who is our sports reporter, or he's the head of the sports department.
It's quite a vast.
Pete has been promoted.
Hey, Pete.
Hey, how we doing?
How you doing, Pete?
Okay, I'm glad for the promotion. Thank
you're,
you.
You're,
and a as lot I, of responsibilities. I got to take a nap.
Yeah.
I don't blame you.
Yeah, well,
it's an unruly
they
bunch.
Were so stimulating here. Pete, anything? Last time we spoke on the show, we were talking about the incredible signing of Trevor Plouffe for the Phillies. Anything else going on since then?
Well, they've got another outfielder. Spent a little bit of money on the guy. What's his name? Harper?
The guy who was choked by Jonathan Papelbon. I was watching the video yesterday.
The guy who's had two good years in his seventh season. But that's, you know, nevertheless, he's the greatest player that ever lived. I've always been skeptical about Bryce Harper. I'm not, you know, he's obviously a top echelon talent. That goes without saying. You look at his career numbers, though, and there's some disquieting things about them. And I've always thought he wasn't a pan of, you know, to compare him to Mike Trout to me is absurd, since Trout does so many things well, and other than one injury, really has played every day for his entire career, while Harper's had his share of downtime. And you wonder about that with the expectations that are going to come with $330 million. So I'm not as excited about the signing as I know a lot of the astute Philadelphia sports fans are.
As sarcasm is dripping out of his mouth. My take on it is this, and I agree with you. I you know, he has made big slumps. He had a slump for half a season last year. He's a 245 hitter. You know, we already had Ryan Howard, who had some phenomenal years, but when he was hitting close to 300 or over 300, that right field fence is what's going to make this whole thing. I mean, he's going to be popping balls out of that ballpark just by if he makes contact. And I think that's how they're looking at it.
Right, I know. But if you look at you look at some of his analytics, and I just happened to talk to a couple of scouts. We were talking about places to drink. We weren't really talking about much else. But,
it's baseball, but what else are they talking about?
You know, a lot of them say the same thing, that Harper's power is you know, unquestioned, and so a short porch isn't going to necessarily give him an extraordinary advantage simply because his home runs are no doubters.
Right.
And he also is not one to hit a lot. He's not one to have a lot of long fly out outs if you go through the analytics of the stuff, which is somewhat stomach turning. But, you know, you just wonder, I hope he has a great year. I hope he hits 50 home runs. The problem is that his premier year, the year he was MVP, was 4 years ago. And ever since then, something has happened. Slumps, injuries. Not as good a year as you thought he has. And while some of the peripheral numbers that the new numbers goo-goos love to talk about really don't translate into pennants. And remember, this is a guy that played for a team for 7 years that never won a playoff series, even though he often had the best team in the league. So while that was not all his fault, certainly he bears a big part of that. So we'll see how it unfolds. I'm sure that those Phillies fans who I covered with love so many years will give him every benefit of the doubt. I'd say maybe two at-bats, maybe three at-bats.
I was going to say three strikeouts and the booze will come raining down on the guy.
If he can work one of those important walks, he doesn't steal bases anymore, by the way, because of his physical aspects. But, you know, maybe if he gets a walk in those first three at-bats, they'll hold off for another day.
Well, one more thing, Pete, on the consumer end of this, the ticket prices are just insane. It was the minimum was $99 for an outfield seat, and then I saw them going up to $1,800, and they're probably up to $2,000. So I did a little bit of research, and I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I had a cork board in my room. I can still see those World Series tickets from 1964 that my mother pinned on the cork board. So I looked up the prices, and they were going for $1.50 to $10 just for the World Series opening day what year are we in?
1890 2000 1890
what year are we in?
I believe it's 2019
whatever year we're in.
I help out when I can.
It's not even the World
Series. Are you the Trump director of calendars?
I'm going to take over
sort of a fake news thing. Even the calendars.
We could probably convince everyone.
I just qualified. I think I just made my bones with that.
I think you did.
I think
it's
the price
1890.
Stuff, it always works itself out. It occurs to me, though, that these big prices for seats could very much fluctuate as the season goes on.
Yeah.
You know, if they fall 10 games out of first place and Harper's just having a pretty good year, I suspect you can get a lot of good seats available around July 1st on.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Oh, well, I hope it doesn't work that way. But listen, Pete, as always, thank you for your astute insight and
humor. Thank you, Pete. I appreciate it.
Yep. Take care. Thank you.
You too.
Thank you, Pete. Take care. Bye. Pete Pascarelli always has a great perspective on everything.
Yeah, you know, you pay a lot for it, a winning season, but I think the consumers
getting screwed
are always on the receiving end.
Well,
of the
every game. I mean, you know, to go down to one game, even if they lower the prices to $50 or something, you take a family of four, it's $200, the ridiculous parking where you got to walk 2 miles, and then the food, which is out of this world, you're talking about easily a $300 day.
Yeah, yep. Yeah.
Anyway, enough of baseball. It's very depressing to think about that.
And consumer law is such an up topic.
Well, somebody's got to fight. And that's what Larry
right.
and I do.
That's right.
We fight for the individual. And,
yay.
You know, that's what we're here for. And before we get back to the Smith matter, we have a bottom feeder of the week. And also, you can kind of combine them, the Mick Mulvaney moment of the week.
It's always combined.
Larry, do you know who Mick Mulvaney is?
I'm not sure.
He was the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Board.
Oh, yes, I do. Yeah.
And at Bureau. And the reason he was put in charge by Trump was because as a congressman, he said it was a totally wasted agency, and it's ridiculous, because their role is to enforce the rights of consumers against the giant banks and other industries that are really taking advantage of people and hurting them with usurious interest rates and unconscionable contract terms. So Mick Mulvaney came in and just abused the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and really took away a lot of the enforcement. And now they put this lady.
And that was his job. He did it successfully.
Yeah, he did it successfully. And he came in. There's a lady now in charge of it who I don't remember, her name escapes me right now, and she said, "Well, we're going to do it our own way." Well, she
our
had the same
way.
Path. And you know, so basically, you know, the bottom feeder of the week is whomever's in charge of that Consumer Financial Protection Bureau after Richard Cordray was kicked out of the position. There's also a lawsuit that was filed under the Fair Credit Reporting Act against Equifax. Now, if you remember, Equifax had a breach for like 150
huge.
Million people.
Yeah.
Their personal information was compromised. Well, this particular lady sued them. It's down in Georgia, and it's a class action lawsuit where Equifax had listed a debt that she owed that she didn't owe. She actually won a judgment against the company, and the company was reporting it as though she still owed them the money. So she sent a dispute letter, which is required under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, saying, I don't owe this debt. Here's the judgment. Equifax wouldn't get rid of it. They allegedly contacted the original creditor. They said, no, she owes the debt. Well, now they're getting sued for a lot of money because she was denied a mortgage. She couldn't get credit because they wouldn't remove this erroneous trade line from her credit report. So that's our bottom feeder of the week is Equifax and anybody associated with Mick Mulvaney.
Well, and the new director is Kathy Kreninger.
Right. That was the name. It escaped me for some reason. It's not like an easy name like Michael Forbes and Larry Rubin or Nancy Forbes.
Yes, that's true.
Virtually everybody's affected by Equifax.
You're right.
Everybody in the country.
And most people don't know they can do anything about it.
Yeah.
Well, when you think of people who actually have credit reports, the amount of people, I forget the statistics, but it's not necessarily 300 million people. There's a lot of people that fly under the radar. So it's a large chunk of the population. So anyway, getting back to the Smith case, because I love this case. And I another time I was in front of Judge Burr and the lawyer was making an argument. I'm objecting. And he just picks up the Smith case. He goes, did you ever hear of this? And he makes the lawyer come to the bar of the court and hands it. He goes, what do you think of that? Again. So you get the trial. You now have this guy, the Commonwealth Financial, the debt buyer, puts this witness, Venditti, on the witness stand. So what he's trying to do is say, your client, Larry Smith, owes X amount of dollars. This is her credit card. This is the contract, because essentially these are contract
cases. That wasn't
cases.
Even the contract. It was a contract from maybe 5 years after she got the card.
Right.
And it had an incorrect interest rate on it. So all the time he's saying that the records are authentic and that they're credible and that you can rely on them. The judge says, well, you don't even have the right interest rate on the contract. And he says, but, Your Honor, they're what's called SAS 70 certified. And so Judge Burr says, what is that, an airline?
That's what it sounds like.
And he kept insisting, because this was really his bag of tricks was open and he had one goof in it, and that was his insistence that it was SAS certified, which actually he never produced any, now that I think about it, he never produced any documents. I totally missed this at trial. You know how you miss things?
Yeah, 10 years later.
I screwed that up. But he never produced any certified documents to say that they were this thing that Judge Burr called an airline. But anyway, the SAS certification, even if it existed, does not meet what the Superior Court later found that they needed, and actually what was the law at the time insofar as authentication, because you just can't say things are certified by an outside agency. They have to. There's a certain standard that you have to meet when you're proving a business record in a court of law.
And a business record of a...
Of anybody, actually.
Well, of anybody, but also of the preceding creditor, the preceding entity that had the contract.
Wait, but is there such a thing as SAS?
Yeah, it's an airline.
Yeah, I actually don't know.
Oh, okay.
But he was saying it was SAS certified because that was the computer system, I think, that he was,
No, it was an outside, independent, non-governmental agency that we were supposed to rely on without any authority.
But it doesn't matter.
Wow.
It's just, you know, look, I have an accounting degree, but I never used it, but I do remember the concepts of it. Yeah, believe it or not. And I remember them talking about FIFO and LIFO and then GEICO, which was the garbage in, garbage out. Mm. So you could have the most perfect computer system in the world that never makes mistakes, but if the person inputting the information puts the wrong information in, everything flows from there.
Right.
It's all wrong.
Well, the Superior Court is in charge of making... Actually, the Supreme Court is in charge of making rules for the common police courts and all the courts in the state. And they spoke on the topic. They said, look, if you want to get a business record in, there are five things that you have to... Actually, there are four plus trustworthiness at the time. It's
right.
changed.
Yeah.
Now it doesn't have to be trustworthy. I'm kidding.
No, it has to be. Well, it shifts the burden
a
little bit.
Now it can be a lie.
Bit. Yeah, it shifts the burden over a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, that's that's a joke, actually.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking.
It went right over my head.
Yeah. I mean, post-Trump, it doesn't have to be. Nothing has to be true anymore.
Well, everything's
that's
on fire.
Yeah, everything's.
We are in 1890.
It's fake
yeah.
evidence, right?
That's true. So, I'm going to use that in the yeah. fake evidence.
Fake evidence.
Probably get some angry emails about that.
You might.
Yeah. So, him talking about SAS whatever really was nothing. It really did not comply with the rules. And so he was on a cross-examination, and I was asking him questions. And I was trying to get him to say that he never even talked to the record, to the previous record holder. Actually, there had been two record holders prior to
right.
Commonwealth. There was one called NCOP.
Yep.
And then there was Citibank. Citibank is the original credit
right.
card issuer.
So it was double hearsay.
Double hearsay. So Citibank sells it to a company called NCOP. NCOP sells it off to Commonwealth.
And just so, you know, for people who are listening, hearsay is like whisper down the lane.
Mm.
You know, Nancy tells me this. I tell Larry that. Larry tells Jamie this. And by the time it gets to the second, third person, it's not necessarily mm-hmm. the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, know, it's any kind of out-of-court declarant.
Right.
You know, that's not admitted, that's admitted for the truth. So it doesn't have to, it can be one person. It can be a person that's not in the courtroom today.
Right.
So it doesn't even have to be that corrupted. In terms of,
but this was one of the main issues there. That, I'm glad you brought that up. Was that you got into this discussion about how, and Judge Burr put it in his opinion, how they were not able to prove that the original creditors, they couldn't prove the software that was used. They couldn't prove that the transactions were done. The input of the information when somebody would make a payment
contemporaneous.
Or was done at the same time contemporaneously as when the somebody paid or they marked it up as not being paid. But the other thing what I found interesting was they got into whether or not the computer system or the software was corrupted and what safeguards, you know, what kind of antivirus mechanisms were in that. And this Venditti couldn't prove anything and he was being very evasive, wasn't he?
Yeah, I had asked him about that because I knew something about computers and storage of data and all that. And I was asking him, do you use any virus software or did they back it up? What did they do to protect it from corruption? What did they do to protect it from hacking? And he would say, no, it's SAS certified. And so I said, I didn't ask
you that. We still don't know what that is.
I didn't. You know, just there's a lot of hand waving going on. You know, don't pay no attention to that man behind the curtain again. And I would say, no, Mr. Venditti, you know, would you kindly answer the question? Did you even speak to NCOP or Citibank? And he goes, I told you it was SAS certified. And I'd say, no, that's an interesting comment that you make, but it's not at all responsive to the question. I would ask him the question again, and he would say, all I know is that it's SAS 70 certified. That's it. And I said, so you don't know. I said, did you ever talk to NCOP about what I just asked you about the trustworthiness of the records? And finally, after about eight pages of wasted testimony, where I'm sure the court reporter's fingers were coming off at that point, he says, no. And I said, whew, thank you.
You know,
obviously it made an impression on the court, you know, because it was referenced. And the fact that backing up, Judge Burr said, the man is saying it's SAS certified with all this computer authentication and all that, but the interest rate is not even the same as it is on the contract.
He gets stuck on stuff like that.
Right. And so how could it be, you know, how could it be that reliable?
Right.
And he said, well, the records have to be reliable because in this age of computers, everything is reliable now, and we depend on it. And the fact that we depend on it makes it reliable. So.
Well, he had the wrong judge because Judge Burr is not only kind of like old school, but he also has declared many times that he goes by the rules of common sense. And none of that made any sense that this guy was talking about with that SAS airliner,
right.
SAS 70 or whatever it was. So, the transcript was very interesting, and you know, the your questions were great. I mean, I wouldn't have known anything.
Thanks.
I now use that all the time. What about the computer system and the corrupt? I'm reading directly.
Cheating off a lawyer.
Well, I made a Smith questionnaire, and I've given it out to many other lawyers. They're going, that's really smart. I said, yeah, I know. You know,
that's great.
Yeah.
Well, there was a whole bootstrapping thing going on there. I must be correct, otherwise I wouldn't be here, and I'm here, so I'm correct.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
that was a good reasoning. What's
we
up,
we have
Nancy?
To start wrapping up now.
Okay. Well, I want to thank our guest, Larry Rubin. I was going to call you Larry
Thank
Smith.
You, Larry.
You get all mixed up now. Now your son and daughter are here. And,
it's been great having them, too.
Jamie and Aileen.
Rachel.
Why did I think your name was Aileen?
I don't know.
Why did I think that? I'm sorry, Rachel. Jamie, that was
close
really
enough.
Random. Okay, Jamie and Rachel, I'm sorry. And we really thank you for coming on the show.
And thank you to Pete and for Rich for calling
in.
My pleasure, yeah.
Thank you, Larry.
All right, have a great day, everybody.
Be well.